Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Johan, we're ready to go. Really appreciate you taking the time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. Before we jump in and talk about all the great stuff in in the dark world of venture capital, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, where you come from? Would love an opportunity to get to know you a little bit more.
Fantastic. Well, John, first of all, thanks for the invite. It's always a privilege to meet fellow VCs and share some battle stories, on our way to greatness via the founders that we work with. So my name's Johan Hanekom, originally from South Africa. I currently live between New York and London. I've been in the venture capital space on and off over the last 10 years. I had two of my own startups that I scaled and sold. I then worked in corporate venture capital, then joined the full-on corporate space working for companies like Liberty Global and Amazon as a principal for innovation, and then realized that I think with the way the world is evolving and the rapid pace of change, startups are really where we're going to solve the world's hardest challenges going forward. Large corporates have a role to play in that, but I do genuinely believe that small, decentralized, super agile teams working on really hard challenges are a privilege to be working within. And the absence of one's own idea, you might as well work with great founders and help them raise the money they need to get those ideas off the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. Quite a background. Quite a few things I want to unpack with you, especially on the CVC, kind of the corporate venture capital side. But before we do that, tell us a little bit more about your fund. What do you invest in? What do you look for?
Yeah, so we have an active fund. It's called our Bamboo Fund. It's our first fund. We tend to invest seed to Series A with a strong focus on series, only because on seed funding, because a lot of the startups that we're working with are, like I said initially, focusing on bleeding edge challenges. So in the absence of revenue, it's very hard to raise capital, right? Your idea needs to be game changing. And so we try and zone into those founders who have an interesting background. They've got the right to play in the space that they're in. And even if they're pre-revenue, if the fundamentals that they're playing to make sense and they've got a well-thought-through idea of what they want to do and a clear path towards revenue, we're more than happy to get involved. We do offset some of our risk by actually investing in companies that have revenue. They're not looking to scale, so that's more on the seed to Series A side of things. And we tend to focus on robotics, defense, and health tech, because those three verticals offer a right to play in both realms. So it's dual purpose. So in our robotic space, there's a lot of focus on defense. There's also a lot of focus on health tech. So some of the intellectual property that we're building out in the health tech space for augmented robotics, we can also apply that to manufacturing, right? Roboticizing of manufacturing facilities. And so we're starting to see this theme evolve where we have multiple verticals we play into, but those three themes really dictate where we spend and invest our time.
Very interesting. Any particular geographic focus?
We're geographic agnostic, and we're starting to see a lot of innovation coming out of Africa, which is a very encouraging space to be seeing that level of high-tech innovation. The pockets are obviously much smaller because there's less venture capital that's able to fund these opportunities. The biggest markets are still the US and Asia. So we're looking at those as the end customers that we want to do business with. But from an ideation point of view, we're geographically agnostic. So we have interesting, you mentioned Kazakhstan earlier. We've got some interesting startups in Kazakhstan we're working with battery production for the e-mobility space. We've got startups in the unmanned aerial vehicles from South Africa for use in California with wildfire detection and suppression. We've got startups in Central America that are doing projects for end customers in Asia. So we've really taken a global look at things, and I think that's it's an encouraging development where you get to export talent across the world based on where you are. So if you're in Kazakhstan, there's no reason why you can't compete with someone in Silicon Valley.
it resonates on so many levels because we take a very similar approach from enterprise SaaS, kind of where we invest and we love focusing on emerging markets and also the technologies that are being then scaled to much larger markets. So definitely very interesting in areas where you guys play in. What's the meaning of the fund? How did you guys come up with that? What does that stand for?
Yeah, so I've always had a fascination with patient capital in life. So bamboo is analogous to that. It's a very sustainable source of material. So we do have a heavy focus on sustainability as well as a business outcome. But it's really that realization that great ideas can take a long time to gestate and to show their potential. So, you know, and bamboo grows dozens of meters in a period of weeks after having been in a fairly static state for, you know, 5 to 7 years. So we're trying to also present the fund as an evergreen fund where we're not just going to be with you for a round, you know, or for a very short period of time. We do want to grow with you as your business evolves. And I think for a lot of funds out there, the challenge is to actually get on board earlier. Because the way I see it evolving is that we're busy working with a company now that's raising $250 million as part of their Series F, so the battery swapping business. I don't see many of those opportunities crossing my desk anymore. And I think there'll be fewer going forward because we're able through technology now to get to profitability quicker. And so the need to raise again will be limited going forward. That's my theory, at least, which is why we have such a heavy focus on getting in early versus waiting until the Series B or C to then see that it's been proven and then we get to write big checks. I think those types of opportunities are starting to dwindle. So we've taken the decision to get on board earlier and grow with these founders. And that way we also get to know the founders better, the management style. We get to influence the culture and the strategy of the business much earlier and set that trajectory as high as possible.
VC is a very long-term game, as you know, and you know it's a heavy focus for me as a co-partner of a early fund. We're fund one as well, and the primary emphasis in those early conversations with the founders is on that relationship aspect and how we build relationship and having that long-term view from both sides. Tell us a little bit more about your strategies that really help you cultivate and maybe build that relationship early on with the founder, maybe even before you guys decide to invest. What are some of the things that really help you kind of suss that out, that this is something that you want to get involved with long term?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think the harsh reality of it is that it's a culture-based trading that we're doing, right? Culture and trust. So, and culture is it's way more than just the culture you're born into. It's what kind of culture do you subscribe to in your business? What is the culture of the business? What kind of, how do you treat your staff? You know, how do you conduct yourself when times are difficult? These are obviously very hard metrics to surface from a pitch deck. And so we spend a lot of time going to conferences and startup events to get to know these founders as early on in their journey as possible. And I'm sure, and I'd be curious to understand if you also tap into your wider network, you know, and for us, that's often where some of our best ideas have come from. So, you know, 5 or 6 degrees of separation. I literally this morning had breakfast with a venture capitalist out of South Africa, where we have a very similar network that we share. And so we already have a lot of implied trust between us, even though we've never done any business together. But there's at least a foundation on which to build. And whatever we build on that is going to be solid. I think with VCs, the challenge now is that you need to be willing to get stuck in with the investments that you're making. I think that era of a very sanitary investment where every 3 months you check in with a monthly board meeting and you give them a hard time and you extract yourself and 3 months later they see you again, that doesn't work anymore. I think founders especially are also becoming more clever with saying, I don't just want your money, I want your network. I want you to help sponsor me into opportunities and not just give me advice, but actually say, you know, Jan, I need someone in Florida who is in the leisure sector to help me introduce my autonomous robot that picks up golf balls. And you're like, yeah, I know someone in Palm Beach that owns a bunch of golf resorts in the US. I'll put you in touch with them for lunch. Let's go to West Palm Beach and have lunch with them. Like that's I can get money from anywhere. That level of sponsorship is hard. And that, so now the VCs are having to also invest more in building their own networks to be a value to the founders. And I think this is where the ecosystem gets very interesting. And even VC to VC cooperation, like we are doing, right? It's not just, oh, you're a VC, therefore you're a threat to me. It's actually opposite. Because you're a VC, I want to speak with you because my cohort of founders that I'm working with might be of interest to you because you're in a different stage, or even if you're early stage, there are lots of great companies that are not being seen or heard because they don't have the community access that you and I enjoy. So, you know, you might have someone that you know who's looking to enter the European market. It might be an area you're not particularly interested in or strong in, but together, you know, I think you give them a pan-European, pan-North America view of things, which doubles their chances of success or quadruples it even.
That's very refreshing to hear, because I actually recently did a post that struck a chord on LinkedIn about VCs needing to collaborate versus compete. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's exactly what you're talking about from that standpoint, because at the end of the day, it's the founder who wins. So that makes a lot of sense. Give us a glimpse into your very first meeting with the founder. Outside of the pitch deck, outside of the data room and all of the due diligence that you and your team will do, that one-on-one, that first conversation, do you prep for that? Do you have a structure to that? Or do you just go a little bit more organic and try to see how the flow, I guess, happens, mm-hmm. you know, naturally within the conversation? What are some of the questions you like to ask? What do you look for? Give us a little bit more in terms of that very first meeting.
Yeah, it's again a phenomenal question. And reflecting on this breakfast that I had this morning with another VC, they introduced me to a firm that they're looking to raise for. Met with them, and they were prepped and ready to answer all the questions related to their deck. And you know, the classic thing is you go on the call, you do some introductions, and they bring up the deck wanting to take you through it. And I just said, look, I've already reviewed it. My team's analyzed it. We've taken a position on what we think is good or bad about it. But what I really want to hear from you is what is your 5 to 10 year vision for your business? And what is your big why behind this? Like, how did you get involved in this thing that you're doing? What's your origin story? And for me, at least, John, that's been the best way to get to know the founder. So we invested in a pharmaceutical company for Alzheimer's disease. And this particular founder had several family members who had been affected by Alzheimer's. And so for them, there's a real personal reason for wanting to fix Alzheimer's, right? To address the challenge. If you're just doing it because it's a huge market and there's lots of money to be made, that's a very weak reason for doing it. And your pitch deck will give me all the financial reasons why you're doing it, but not the personal reason why. And especially when things get hard in a business, which, as you know, it's very quick for that to happen. You know, the starting line, there are a lot of balloons and people clapping for you, and at the finish line, but it's the part in between where there's no one to be seen. So when you hit that part of the journey, in the absence of results or success, what fuels you to keep going, to burn the midnight oil, to work weekends, you know, and miss parties and holidays and all that stuff that's the reward of success, in order to achieve that success that you're looking for? So for me, that's my first thing. And you know, I look forward to the comments on this video when it goes live. That's how I do things. You know, for me, that works. It also plays to, I'm looking for the heart in the person, not just the mind, because I'm assuming you're intelligent. I'm assuming you've thought through your business idea. I'm assuming that you've done your homework with regards to your total addressable market and how much of that you're going to achieve and the challenges and the competitors. Like, those are all things which are generically expected, but to understand your personal motivation for it, that to me is the real differentiator. So some people are uncomfortable with it because it's like, okay, now I've got to get the emotions going, and you know, but it is, I think that's where you get to meet the real person. And funny enough, my first business, when we were acquired, that was one of the reasons why we were acquired. Yes, we had great IP and great technology we had created, but they were very curious to understand our bigger vision for the business. And when they truly believed in that, we also got a much higher valuation because there was something real that they were building up to. It was a small Lego piece in a much bigger building set. We were a small part, and they could see that first stepping stone through the acquisition.
Yeah, I was, as you were explaining, I reflected on a couple of meetings I recently had as well with founders, where it was interesting to see a little bit of a surprise in them that I didn't want to go through the pitch deck. It's just, you know, something that could easily do separately, but kind of that emphasis on that interpersonal relationship, and also what you're talking about, that's kind of the why. And because at the end of the day, it's very challenging, very difficult, and it's very lonely for the CEO at the top. So how do you keep going? So that resonates. It makes a lot of sense.
I would probably go one step further and say, if your VC that you're working with isn't interested in understanding your long-term vision and your why, and if they're only going through the deck, which is quite a superficial conversation, I would see that as a red flag personally. Mm-hmm. Because you're not investing in my vision, you're not investing in my think big, you're investing in an asset class that you want to make a return on investment in. So now I'm just a commodity. And unfortunately, that's not why people get involved in VC or the PE space. Like, it is about the founder's vision. And if you don't ask that question, how can you invest in the vision, right?
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the learnings from your anti-portfolio. You know, in a sense, the companies that maybe you had passed on or had the opportunity to invest in, and for whatever reason, it didn't happen, but it's something that, you know, may have worked out for them great. What are some of the learnings, and how did that impact your investment strategy in general, or if it ever did, share a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so there are a whole bunch. One of them was Monzo, which is a big digital bank here in the UK, one of the first that were launched. I personally had an opportunity to get involved there, and I didn't quite understand the sector well enough to appreciate what they were doing. And banking is a very regulated topic here in the UK, so that was a big miss from my side. I think there are, with any kind of speculative thing that one does in life, venture capital, even trading public commodities or public equity trading, you're always going to have that wisdom and hindsight experience. Retrospectively, we could all have invested, you know, in Apple in 2007 versus buying an Apple iPhone for $1,000, and we would have had a phenomenal return on our investment, right? I think it's wise to know that we are going to miss out on a lot of great investments along this journey. And so you really need to get comfortable with your reason for investing in a company, because when it doesn't work out as well, which does happen regularly in the VC space, you need to have that comfort with, I did my due diligence, I went through my screening criteria as per my investment methodology, and I have a peer group that I consult with either in the investment committee or the other general partners to make sure that we're taking a measured approach to this. I think what we're seeing currently is this fear of messing up. So it's less FOMO, fear of missing out, and more fear of messing up. And it's like, wow, this company has a great AI solution. It looks like it's going to change the narrative and completely change industries upside down. We'd be foolish not to, you know, invest X amount of money. I think that's where the greed is very dangerous. So you should always be opportunistic. You should always be looking at where the gaps in the market are. But comfort yourself with, some of these opportunities may have taken 8 to 10 years to reach profitability. You look at like Ubers and others in this space, where if you didn't have patient capital, if you weren't a long-term investor, if you weren't invested in the next version of their business, which is robo-taxis, that's the end goal, right? How does today's market adoption, lots of users on the platform, then translate into profitability in 10 years' time? Mm-hmm. So looking at your appetite for risk, looking at how much time you have available for exposure, and then comforting yourself with picking some of the good investments as well. Now, it's, you know, we can't capture all of them. And I think, you know, there are a couple of VCs out there that celebrate great opportunities for investment that never happened, where, you know, like, you know, the Airbnb founder was in their office pitching this idea of a dating site, and they were like, well, we're not really interested in that, or converting it into another app, and then all of a sudden it's successful. So, but it's a privilege even to miss out on great opportunities. At least you had the chance to have a look at them, right?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, we could probably do an entire episode dedicated to that, because it's just endless. endless list that's only going to keep growing. So that makes a lot of sense where you talk about. To switch topics a little bit, you've mentioned you spent some time in the corporate sector, especially in the CVC, corporate venture capital. In simple terms, explain what is CVC, what does it do, what is it for?
Yeah, so CVC is an opportunity for a large firm to dip its toe into adjacent markets. It's an opportunity to see where the next tranche of growth for the core business will come from. And in many ways, it's an insurance policy. So you see lots of established firms where their core business is generating a significant positive cash flow. They've got capital that they can invest, and their core industry is slowly but surely starting to slow diminishing rates of return. And so they need to find the next growth engine while still servicing their current customer base. So it's a very clever business model. I think the challenge that CVCs face is you've been brought into the organization, or you've been raised within the organization to challenge the status quo. And for anyone that's worked in the corporate space, it's very hard to challenge the status quo, because if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And so companies that I've seen with very successful corporate venture capital arms are the ones who are willing to really push the boat out and experiment with adjacent markets to find those moonshot opportunities. One of them that I work with is LG Ventures, phenomenal outfit. You know, they're happy to look at all sorts of weird and wonderful investment opportunities outside of LG's core business, because that's how LG went from being a face cream to a technology giant, right? They evolved very quickly with their product portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very interesting. And I think it's a relatively, you know, untapped opportunity for large corporations to, like you said, tap into adjacent markets and stay, you know, innovative, essentially, from kind of disrupting themselves. So that's definitely a great opportunity for companies to diversify and just see what other opportunities are out there. Johan, in conclusion, share a little bit more about your personal strategies to stay informed and stay educated in terms of content you can consume, your content diet, because as VCs, you know, we all always on that hunt to stay, you know, at least a little bit ahead of the curve, and also keep ourselves educated in different opportunities that we're underwriting. What are some of the things that you could share?
Yeah, there are obviously public sources of information. Like, I think LinkedIn has become, if you follow the right people, a great way to stay abreast. Same with X, if you're following thought leaders on there who are giving you snippets of information of what's to come down the road. And obviously industry journals as well. This is why it's important to have an industry focus, because then at least you get to develop a deep understanding of that vertical, so that when you start seeing the gaps and you start seeing these startups that are presenting ideas to you, you know that they're onto something, because you can sense it as well, just like they do. Mm-hmm. I will say, I think one of the superpowers that one needs to develop, if depending on your levels of ambition within the VC space, but if you're looking to become one of the all-time greats in this space, from what I've been mentored, is you need to have a contrarian idea, right? A contrarian idea that is completely misunderstood by your own peer group in this space, and you need to have an absolute conviction in it. So it can't just be, I'm trying to be different and therefore I'm right. It's, I've got a different view on things. I really believe it's the right thing. And then you need to be willing to spend many, many months, if not years, proving yourself right with that contrarian idea. And it's a huge ask, because you're either going to be right or completely wrong. But if you're right and you've spent years being the outlier, you will enjoy a first mover advantage, which will be nearly impossible to catch up with, at least until there's another super cycle. So this is like going back to 1995 and Jeff Bezos meets you in Seattle and says, I'm thinking about selling books online. What do you think? And you're like, sure. Are you looking to raise? Yeah, I'm raising, you know, $50,000. I'm raising $1 million and $50,000 checks, you know, for 20% equity in my business. Cool. I'll give you $1 million for 20% of Amazon. Fantastic. I mean, that was happening in 1995, right? There were people writing $50,000 checks to get equity in Amazon, which now gets you barely anything. Mm-hmm. And so I think if you can have these contrarian philosophies that you subscribe to, and to find the quirkiest founders out there who are completely misunderstood by the rest of the VC community. If they are in line with your contrarian view, keep investing in them, because that could just be the next big super cycle that you've unlocked, and you've got the winners in your portfolio.
Well, Johan, I really appreciate all of the valuable insights you shared in this very short and, you know, packed with knowledge conversation. I personally learned quite a bit, so I definitely really appreciate you taking the time and looking forward to staying in touch with you and with all the guests. I love doing follow-up recordings in about a year to see how much of change transpired. So definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
Thank you, Jan. And let's make sure that we have a deal or a couple of deals that we can include in that follow-up.
That's right. That's the plan.
So joint deal.
That comes off too.